Have you ever thought about that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? I did. I actually bought two homes in Albuquerque that I Airbnb'd, and it was just an amazing investment, honestly, because, you know, as you are accruing value in your property, you are also making money on the Airbnbs. It's amazing. So your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
21 Seeds infused tequila is a must-have. It's an award-winning tequila. It's infused with real juice, with real fruit, which means the flavors are built in. It's real. So you need like two or three ingredients to make your perfect cocktail. Hey, you know how I'm always trying to keep my house parties exciting? New cocktails? Do you?
Yeah.
I feel like here's something that's going to flip the script.
Okay.
All right. 21 Seeds infused tequila.
Yeah. Tell me more about this, right? Oliver Hudson.
Yeah, 21 Seeds is an award-winning tequila that's infused with juice from real fruits. You only need two to three ingredients to make the perfect cocktail.
Wait a minute. I think I know what brand you're talking about. You know why?
Yeah.
Because 21 Seeds is founded by two sisters and their friend. It's female founded.
That's right.
See?
Sounds
See
like
how I know? Something I can get behind.
I know. Well, there's a good story behind that for sure. Listen, if you love tequila, you have to try 21 Seeds infused tequila. Enjoy responsibly. 21 Seeds, Diageo, New York, New York.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Kate Hudson.
And my name is Oliver Hudson.
We wanted to do something that highlighted our relationship.
And what it's like to be siblings.
We are a sibling rivalry.
No, no.
Sibling rivalry.
Don't do that with your mouth.
Sibling rivalry.
That's good.
Okay.
Okay.
Here we are on another episode of Sibling Rivalry where there is no sibling.
Well, sort of. Definitely not your sibling.
No, no, but it's been Aaron and I for a minute. Mm-hmm. Kate's been busy traveling the world, working, being fabulous. And so now I have you.
I know, that sounds like a real compromise, which really bugs me.
No, it's
now there's you.
It's not a compromise.
Now there's you. How about this? How about this?
And you've been on this show.
Now there's you. You know, like that. Instead of like,
well, first you gotta hold the mic.
Now there's you.
More to your face.
What?
Yeah, you can't be waving the mic like that.
Oh.
Yeah. And okay. Now there's you.
I like that.
Is that better?
Yeah.
You've been on the show before, but you've been a host.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you're a host, but you're a guest. I don't know what you are. I know you're my mother, in case.
I'm definitely your mother.
In case people haven't recognized the voice yet. But
yeah.
My mother, the great Goldie Jean Hahn, is on with me. Just to chat, we have no idea what we're talking about. We're going to talk about, but it was my birthday yesterday.
I know. Nobody knows better than me.
I know. And I'm 45 years old. And I know that you've told the story before in your book, but my birth was a tough birth.
Yeah.
Almost didn't make it.
I know. Yeah, that was a tough time, you know. I was so big and I literally I didn't think my body would ever go back to normal because you were so big. And then my doctor said, well, you know, you're a few weeks late, but, and I thought, well, I know, but that's kind of weird because I really should go on my date. And then I wondered if I could actually have a baby that big, meaning what is my pelvimetry and could my baby come out? And so finally I went into back labor
Go into labor?
Oh, yeah, I did. I went into back labor, which is different.
Oh.
Your back is like, you know, it's spasming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was sort of in my mid to lower back area. And I thought, you know, something's not right. And it's not like I was having contractions in my belly. I was having them in the back. And I went, I better go to the hospital. And I went in at 6 o'clock at night, I mean, in the morning, and rushed in, and they got me, started, you know, looking at me, but they didn't give me an IV or anything. And I was just, they were just waiting for me to do some dilating back then, right?
And this was 3 weeks past my birthday?
It was 3 weeks at that point, yeah.
I mean, see, that's crazy though, because they wouldn't do that now.
Never.
So back in the 70s, they just let you cook until you were decided to come out?
Yeah, oftentimes they did. I think my doctor, who I loved, and he had helped me have all my children. but it wasn't so bad to go over. What happened was, is that after I was in the hospital, oh my God, I was there all day long, and I had everybody examining, but, you know, somebody's uncle, and, you know, I'd more like, hey, you'll put your hand on the thing and let's see. And I didn't dilate. I was only dilating like one or something, two maybe. And I had the fetal monitor on at that time. But I had no IV. And I say that for a reason, because I wasn't getting any fluids or anything. And in those days, they didn't give me Pitocin, which helps you dilate and all that stuff. So now I'm feeling the contractions, but nothing's happening. And then suddenly, it was like 7 o'clock at night, and I was there all day. They rushed me in, finally gave me an IV, rushed me in on an emergency C-section because there was fetal distress. And I go in, and now I'm, you know, they're cutting me open. And of course I had the block and everything, so I could hear and see everything. I was totally awake. And then they pulled you out, and then they swaddled you up, and I heard you cough. And it's really interesting. It's not like I'd had a baby before, but something seemed wrong to me. And I said, is that cough okay? And they went, oh yeah, it's just normal. We're just suctioning him. And then they swaddled you up and they put you right near me so I could see you. And I remember looking into your beautiful, oh my God, your face. You were 11 pounds. And I looked in your face and I said, I waited so long for you. And then they whisked you away. And I figured they were going to, you know, do more clean air, whatever. So then a little bit later, as he's sewing me up, I was getting a bit nauseous. And they said, he's in ICU, he's in blah, blah, blah. And I'm listening to this doctor coming into the surgery room. And I said, is that my baby you're talking about? And then the doctor said, just give her something and put her out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, they put you out. They didn't even let you know what was going on.
No.
Jeez.
It was terrible. And I woke up in the ICU, in the recovery room. And
not really knowing what was going on.
No, but I was so thirsty because I hadn't had anything to drink. I had no water. I had truly dehydrated. Mm-hmm. And but I didn't know what happened. And then I learned that my baby might die.
Mom, I'm here. I made it.
What? I know. But anyway, and that you had a 40% chance of living. And I swear to God, I had this incredible instinct. Of course, I was really sore and very out of it. But I couldn't get it. And then they wheeled me into my room, and it was the worst experience because it was dark and all the hallways were dark. And they put me in my bed, and the doctor came into me. He was very upset. And he said, he's going to make it. He's going to make it. And I said, what happened? He said, well, he had a meconium aspiration. And with that is that when they are under like stress and you know, and so the back labor and the, all of it, is that sometimes they make a bowel movement, which is very tar-like substance in your amniotic fluid. And so when you came out, you inhaled it. And that can create a low lobal pneumonia.
I like ate shit and almost died.
You kind of, well honey, come on. I mean,
essentially, I took a dump.
You did.
And then I breathed in my dump.
Well, you did, but I mean, you don't have to say it like that. I mean, you can just say, well, I had my first BM. You know, you could do that. You could say, oh, I had my first BM.
I don't think I've ever said BM in my life.
Well, I never have either, but it's better than dump. I mean, come on.
I just couldn't hold it.
Anyway, well, you know, you're a baby. I mean, what could, you know, babies don't hold it. Mm-hmm. They go when they want to go, and that's the way it is. And so anyway, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. The problem was, of course, is that it wasn't so smooth because they took you off the ventilator too soon. And then you fell a little bit lower. Mm. So, but it was an interesting experience. And I say this because now I can look at it, you know. My mom wanted to come see me, but someone wouldn't let her through the door in the recovery. She knew something was wrong, and she was very upset. And then she went home, and my mom went to bed. And she didn't come out of her room for several days. Mm-hmm. Because her first baby had a SIDS test, and she found him. Fed him at 6 o'clock and found him at 8 in the morning, dead in his crib. So my mother, on top of everything, was having this PTSD horrible moment where perhaps I should not have named Edward Rutledge because it was after my father, mm-hmm. and she named him Rutledge too. This was my brother, who I've never met. And so in the Jewish religion, oftentimes, really, that rabbis can say it's a little bit of a Jewish superstition, but you're not supposed to name after the living. Mm-hmm. So my mother couldn't talk to me. I could not talk to my mother, and I couldn't see her either, because if I did, I would have split my gut open. Mm-hmm. And I knew it. I knew that the wailing that would come out of me would have had to have more surgery. Mm-hmm. So after a day, and each time the door opened, somebody'd walk in and they'd say, I think they were going to tell me my baby died. Mm. And I was there just going, oh God, somebody do something. I didn't know what to do. Well, what I found out was is that I was very toxic. So I was being given high doses of penicillin because I was also had toxemia, right? Because that was in my body. So you took your dump, which, you know, I guess it's just, I'm getting used to it now. So,
okay.
But in me, and then I got very toxic. Mm. Well, the second day, the doctor said, and the nurses said, you must go up and see him. And I was so afraid of what would happen if I saw you again and fell in love with you, and you would die.
And you hadn't seen me at this point?
Only from the beginning, wow. Right when they swaddled you.
Right.
But I was afraid that I would fall in love with you instantly, and that would scar me forever mm-hmm. if I'd have lost you. But I got in the wheelchair, and they pushed me up to ICU.
NICU.
Right. Neonatal. Yeah. Oh, yeah, neonatal care. And there you were. You were on a slab of metal.
Jesus.
With heating lamps everywhere and needles everywhere in your head, being given medication. And they had given you Thorazine because you were so big that you were pulling things out and you were active.
Oh, so they sedated
you me. Were sedated, yeah.
Oh, my God.
And you were absolutely gorgeous. You were 11 pounds, so that's like a three-month-old baby lying there, and big and heavy and hefty and amazing. But you also had a low heart rate, which wasn't great. So I did what I would consider maybe the craziest thing, although I am spiritual, I suppose, very much so. But I I stood up and I put my hand over your chest while you were, they were, was breathing for you. And I emptied my, I'm trying to explain what this feels like, but it's almost as if I made my body and my mind hollow. Like just everything was at peace. And everything was just, I emptied out everything, expectation, I emptied out, all of it. And it's very tough to explain.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when I asked God to heal my son through me, to use me as your instrument. I am emptying out everything, and you need to come through me, please, and heal my son. And that was my prayer. And I started looking at your heart monitor, and it was starting to get higher.
Mm-hmm.
So heart rate started to rise incrementally. It was 60-something, then it would go down, then it would go up to 70, then it would go down to 68, and it kept going higher and higher. And you were not conscious. Mm-hmm. Certainly you were conscious because you knew I was there, because all babies know mm-hmm. that their mothers are there. And I called the nurses, and the nurses and the doctor came over and said, Goldie, if more mothers knew that they had the power mm. to heal their children.
So they had probably seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we're trying to get more moms all the way up into NICU more often, because this is very important for them. And so then the days went on. I was discharged, but I would come back to see you because they weren't ready to let you go yet. And I came back 3 times a day to feed you. I schlepped, all the mm-hmm. thing. And for me, I would have gone, the whole thing. And I would sing something to you. Mm-hmm. And when I was washing my hands, I would sing. And I was in the NICU. I would sing, Oliver, Oliver Hudson. And you turned your head toward me, and you were all the way across the room. And when finally, when you were released, and
how
I was
long?
There, you, I think it was about 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and you were released, the nurse, who the neurologist, said, he's very developed, and he does something, you'll be happy to know his neurology is very good, she said. You'll be happy to know that every time you came in, he recognized your voice, and he turned his head toward you. Because I wasn't aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was in their report, right? So that connection was very strong.
Was there a turning point?
Was it.
Right,
The
turning point was like, oh my God, okay, he's on the mend.
Yeah.
Meaning we're out of the woods, and now it's just a matter of time before he yeah. can come home.
Yes, it was about a week, and they started seeing great improvements. Mm-hmm. And that was the sign, right? And I would then come in, and I would, breastfeed you as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you...
I did not. I was horrible.
Lazy. You were one of those special babies, right? So when I took you home, I breastfed you, but you didn't really suck on my breast that much. You mm-hmm. you weren't like voracious.
Right.
You were a little lazy. Mm-hmm. So I took the nipple from, because I also supplemented you because you weren't getting enough. And I put literally put an ice pick in it, a hole, so you didn't have to work so hard.
Oh, God. That set me off on a path for the rest of my life.
Oh, my God.
Well, what's funny is I was, when Wilder is 14 now, but he was born at Cedars, the same hospital that we were all born.
Yeah.
And he's my first, and I went. We had a C-section as well, so we were there for 4 days. And I went to the NICU. I went up to the NICU because that's where I was.
Yeah.
And I get off on the floor, and they're like, oh, sir, like, you're not allowed to be here. You can't just go up there unless your baby's there or something. And I said, oh, my God, I'm sorry. I was actually here, and I was 30 at the time. I was here 30 years ago.
Right.
I was in this NICU.
So crazy.
And then there were a couple of nurses who were, oh, and then no, I was at the front desk, the little thing, and I was like, my name was Oliver Hudson, and there were some nurses back there who recognized the name and came up, and they turned out to be two of the nurses who took care of me when I was in the NICU.
Oh my God, it's, it gives me chills. It's crazy.
And they had a picture of us on the wall, but they, I think they had just taken it down because they were redoing
stuff.
So I met those nurses. I took a picture with them and the whole thing.
You know, it's funny because that's when I put Wilder's name on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted his name up mm-hmm. on the wall because my firstborn had a firstborn.
Mm-hmm. I know, and we've talked about this recently because of all of my insanity, my anxiety that I've been going through in the last 4 or 5 months and just sort of digging into the reasons why or trying to find, you know, the foundation of where it stems from. I've been in therapy for a billion years. I've gone over my life 1,000 times, but it's interesting how, you know, sometimes talking about the same things with a different lens on it, through a different perspective, can sort of open your eyes even wider. And I never even thought about my birth as being the first moments of my life because I wasn't conscious.
That's right.
But that has to have some effect on you and your being moving forward.
There's no question.
Right? I mean, there has to be, because if you think about it, I was whisked away from you. Didn't have mother's love. Put on a metal fucking slab with needles in my head and a respirator.
It was horrible.
I mean, that was my introduction into mm-hmm. this world.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was it's unconscious, how could that not have penetrated or affected who I am in some way?
It does. You know, they have all these regression therapies, you know, that they do now where you're re-experiencing your birth and how you can rewire in a way the way your neurons are firing about your birth when you are put through a facilitator will help you go through your birth in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it makes a lot of sense because you can be traumatized by that without even realizing that you did have trauma. You know, I had trauma, by the way,
mm-hmm.
Because I didn't realize I was so traumatized until I went with Burt Reynolds. We were doing Best Friends. You were 6, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in
Buffalo.
Buffalo.
We were in Buffalo, yeah.
And I went into a NICU there, and we were visiting these kids, and we were doing all this stuff. And it was fine, and I never thought about it. And I went to the NICU, and I had a panic attack.
Mm.
I had to get out. I mean, it was just visceral. It's like in my being. So these things, whether you're conscious or you're unconscious, do matter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we really ask bigger questions about consciousness. Just how much do children really know and feel
mm-hmm.
when they can't speak
mm-hmm.
or when they can't communicate? And we're finding out it's a hell of a lot. So it was something that we did talk about, too, which is examine your birth, because it was really hard, and I wasn't there. I mean, you know, secure attachment, right, is one of the most important things we can be for our children, to be there for you. And I have cried so many times, even in recent time, remembering how I couldn't be there for the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was no such thing in my mind that really knew what secure attachment was. Now, of course, I'm working with children and we're doing all these things for mental health. I mean, of course, it's probably one of the most important things that you can give your child.
Mm-hmm.
So I walk around with my own, I know I couldn't help it, but I wish I would have just known more then and insisted that I stay in the NICU the whole time. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody did at that time, but, you know, it was really...
Well, there's so much more that we know now.
Oh, I know.
Mean, it's unreal.
You know, I do. I really have to say, though, I commend you. You're such an open person, and you're fearless. You are who you are. I love that about you, Oliver. I mean, you don't put on airs. You're funny. You're completely irreverent. You're honest. You tell the truth all the time. And sometimes you go too far, and I look at it and I go, oh my God, what is he doing now? Do I comment on it? Do I leave it alone? But you're idea of sharing, you know, what you're going through, mm-hmm. You know, what you've been through is so important because so many people are feeling mm-hmm. these things now. This is no longer a taboo. You know, we're trying to bring mental disturbances, things that are going on with kids, stuff that goes on with adults, all these areas. You're in self-discovery. You always have been.
Do you see an uptick? Because you do. You know, for those of you who don't know, Mom has been working with kids and the mindfulness of children and the psychology and the science of the brain.
And Mind Up.
And yeah. Mind Up, with Mind Up. And have you discovered, because you've been doing it for 20 years now, actually, it's almost 9/11. I mean, we're coming upon, this episode might even release, no, actually the day before, but this is what was the inspiration behind Mind Up,
exactly.
Essentially.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Then 9/11 came. But have you noticed an uptick in sort of deteriorated mental health in children?
Definitely.
And when would you contribute that to?
Well, anxiety, uncertainty, all the things and the reasons why when our buildings were, and everyone was killed in New York at the Twin Tower and what was happening there, we in the Trade Center, we literally had what I felt is going to be fearful and silent distress in children. I started looking at the statistics. Suicide was climbing for children at that point. And also their anxiety and also the advent of giving them Adderall, you know, different pills and mm-hmm. different psychotropics during that time because they didn't know how to handle a lot of the problems. So they medicated our children. Well, for me, I thought to myself, this is a disaster, right? So what's happening now is that more children, there's more stats on suicide. It's gone way up. Mm-hmm. That's a determinant itself in how desperate our children are. Now, what is the reason for it?
Yeah.
A lot of it could be reasons of sort of climate, meaning I'll just give you one little isolated area. Mm-hmm. We work with Ocean Heroes and work with mindfulness with them. And Ocean Heroes is a great organization. And what they do is that they have all these kids that are actually cleaning the ocean and so forth, but they're becoming more and more aware of, I'm not going to say a feeling of futility mm-hmm. because of the climate crisis we're dealing with. They're very depressed. They're trying to figure out how to fix things. So there's uncertainty, there's fear of the ending of the world. There's areas of what's going on in terms of our politics. Mm-hmm. Nothing. I mean, we've got what's happening today with children is they can't control it. So they have no agency over their emotions, and nor do they have oftentimes parents who are grounded enough mm-hmm. to be able to be there. You, through all of it, are a grounded person, whether you think you are or not. Mm-hmm. That's where you want to be. You choose to do that. You choose to be a great parent. And you are an amazing parent, and so is Aaron. You have three fantastic children. Mm-hmm. That's because you pay attention to them. It's because you're there for them. It's because you go camping together, you play together, you listen to each other. And also you give them modicum amounts of freedom to actually play freely. Mm-hmm. So they start to find out who they are and develop ways that they can manage their own emotions or manage the situation and giving them these tools to be able to do it. But they can't do it themselves. Neurologically, they're just beginning to develop their brain mm-hmm. and it's not finished till they're 25. So we're a huge part of our children's mental health. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so all of it living the outside was these ideas of whoever our leaders are, whatever's going over the news. And also, I'm going to say it, the phone and all of the things that kids are getting into today, they do not promote well-being at all. Mm-hmm. They're always measuring themselves by how many likes they have.
Yeah.
And they're looking at themselves more in the mirror than they are at other people.
No, totally. But there's nothing we can do about that.
Yeah, you
can. That train has left the station.
The train
and it is flying down the tracks. Like, this world of social media, of narcissism, of sort of immediate self-analysis where you don't go develop a photo and look at yourself.
Right.
You can film a video and look, and then boom, you're right
immediately,
there.
Immediately, yeah.
That's just how it's going to be from now on.
So I would say, unfortunately, parents want to be liked. you know, when I say unfortunately, your children will always love you.
I know what you mean, right. You want to be cool. You don't want to be the...
You want to be cool.
Right, you don't want to be the parent who's like, you can't do this.
Exactly. You know, you want that. You want to say, leave that for the grandparents, right? Mm-hmm. But in terms of the being a parent, you have to find your boundaries. You have to find your boundaries as a person. I mean, I remember Katie, you know, was, you know, growing up and, you know, Madonna was like the thing mm-hmm. with Katie. And she was quite young. But I didn't stop her from watching Madonna. Mm-hmm. I thought Madonna actually had a great voice and I loved her music. But I was also looking at certain things that I thought, well, maybe, you know, we've got to look at certain things and comment on them and speak about them. Maybe her costume, or maybe it was the suggestiveness of her way or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I didn't say you can't do that. So therefore, I think parents really need to manage the time that our children are on their what kind of FaceTime they're having, mm-hmm. you know, or technology right, time on time. Right. And say you can't before you go to bed. There's so much research right now. They should be off their devices at least 2 hours before bed.
No, I know. We're terrible at that.
And then with it, you can talk, you can be together, yep. you can go outside, you can whatever, stretch, have fun together, tell stories.
It's amazing what happens when you actually follow through with those rules, which, you know, we try, and then it just gets hard because you can get lazy as parents.
I understand.
You've got three kids, you know, 8, 11, and 14. You know, they go to school, and you're sort of parenting, and then at night, it's like your time. You know, you want mm-hmm. them to just go into their rooms and do their own thing, mm-hmm. so then Aaron and I can have our time to just hang out. If we're constantly on their asses about, like, to get off the tech, get off of this, then it's just, like, up until the last minute. But when it does happen, and we're like, we're done, 10 o'clock, you're done, they all migrate into our room, and they just get on the bed, and then they start fucking around with each other and pushing each other in the best way.
Yeah.
You know, and conversing and communicating.
Family
more.
Time.
Yes,
yeah.
It just naturally happens that way, you know?
I mean, I don't know. Listen, you know, we grew up, you had a pager.
Yeah, that we didn't. Yeah, exactly.
You had to vie for the pager. And I'm thinking, we need that now because you're teenagers, right? But you didn't grow up in that world.
No, totally different.
You just missed it, you know, which was great because your communicative skills are amazing. A lot of our children can't communicate. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing. One little boy in a mind up school, we put mind up in that school, and he said, well, he can't have a conversation now, but maybe when he grows up, he'll be able to have the conversation. Well, he was 10. Right? Mm-hmm. And I thought it was fascinating that he really didn't have the art of conversing because they text all the time.
Mm-hmm.
These are the things we're losing. And in order to sustain well-being, we have to make that happen. So 9:30 devices are all there. To put them right there in my bedroom. Mm-hmm. They're in my bedroom. So you can't come and sneak and get them.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they are. You can come visit us in the bedroom. And I tell you, I think that's what I would do.
It's so hard.
Yeah, I really do. I mean,
it's about balance, you know?
Well, when you're on your camping trip, what's that like?
Yeah, I mean, it's bad. Exactly. You know, you're out in nature. There's no cell service, you know?
How does
that
feel?
We watch movies.
How are the kids? You watch movies?
Yeah, they're good because they know they can't have it. It's just, it doesn't exist. It's not even a possibility. So we have a bunch of movies, you know, like DVDs. And like they're
Which
kind of old school movies.
I know,
and we watch that.
I love that.
The kids, again, it's balance. Like as long as they're outside, as long as they're getting into nature, as long as when we're in Colorado, they're doing their thing.
I agree.
Okay.
Nature
then we
is
have
huge.
That. As long as you're not in your room 24/7 playing video games, which they're not.
They're not. No, your kids are out.
Yeah, they're out. I mean, they like their video games and that's okay.
Yeah, but I mean when we're at the ranch, Bodie will come over. But he's out all day playing.
Yeah.
And you know what? They go ride their bikes, their motorbikes, they're doing their thing, they're all of it. And they're, I'm telling you, and then he'll come up and he'll do it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel bad as a grandparent, I don't want to stop him. That's his good mm-hmm. enjoy time.
But, I think you're already doing this, but like a mind up, because it's for kids, but for parents.
Yes, we have a mind up for parents.
You do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because That's where it starts. No, you know what I mean?
It's it's like the book 10 Mindful Minutes I wrote. Like, parents need to become more mindful or learn. It's not a demand. Mm-mm. It's just almost an imperative. If we want to have mindful children, good kids, happy kids, blah, 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 we have to carry some of these attributes. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, I give them little tips on how to do it, right? So what I'm doing, did just this morning, I was on a Zoom call with the gal who's doing our little, what they call mindful moments for parents. And I'm going through various mindful moments for them. And I just worked on a brain break for them. So parents know how to take a brain break, but also why they're doing the brain break. And then the scientific proof of what it actually does to your brain and your body and your health, right? So this is vital. And so we're launching the end of October, our digital channel, and it's Mind Up for Life. And that's going to be happening, and parent program is right in there. And we just finished one for Snapchat.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So we did a parent program for Snap, yeah.
So you're infiltrating the social medias.
Yeah.
You know.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're going completely digital. It's really, really exciting. And with that, you know, talking about stages of your life, right? Mm-hmm. And when I go, stages of my life, it's like, what do you want to be when you grow up, right? You know, I always said, happy.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say what I want to do. People didn't say, what do you want to do?
Right.
What do you want to be? Well, I said at 11, I want to be happy. And then pretty much in my life was really about, I didn't have to chase happiness. I owned it. I had it in me. I lost it for a while. Another story, but regaining it back with a psychologist and so forth, because yes, I'm like you. I went to figure myself out, right? And so—
Well, that's genetics are funny that way. You know, they talk about anxiety, you know, sort of having a genetic component to it.
Right.
You know, when I went through my first bout in my 20s was just coincided exactly with you
in my
your
20s. Yeah, exactly. And it very well can be.
Yeah.
And so I'm telling you, that's a whole podcast,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's a really interesting fact, right? So, but in terms of what I have done, right, is that, okay, I learned about the brain. I learned about all that. But then I became a producer and I'm an actress and a thing. And it was funny and I really enjoyed everything I was doing. And then I got to a certain time in my life when I moved away to Vancouver for Wyatt to become a hockey player, his dream. I started thinking about my future and the future of our world and wondering, all my philanthropy's always been for children. I always wanted to help them in some way become happier. Well, I started Mind Up. Now, that's been 20 years of my life. I have never been more inspired. I have never felt more excited about what I'm doing. And you know, Oliver, I've been doing this a long time. But now that we're online and we're actually there, I am able to speak to people are doing amazing videos for us. Cardiologists talking about the power of breath and how it affects the brain and how the brain affects the heart because it's so extraordinarily connected, and people don't know that. And we're doing breath experts, we're doing mindfulness experts, we're doing experts on neurobiology, experts on happiness. And I mean, there's so much that we're delving into now about health and wellness, but also about children and parental stuff. So I'm stimulated. So when you look at, will I be doing this all my life? Which is a question that we ask ourselves. Sometimes if you care about more than what you're doing now, that you continue your interests, you keep looking at other things in the world than just what you're doing. Sometimes it leads you to a more purposeful life.
Oh, yeah.
So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. But are you going to act again?
Yeah. I think I'm going to be Mrs. Claus again. I think so.
Well, I mean, it's funny, Mom. Look, you're iconic. You know, you look at Diane Keaton and Meryl and Bette Midler and, you know, all of these people who seem to sort of still be working here and there, right? Or Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin and all of this. You know, you have just, it's almost like you had to almost carve your own path because no one knew where to put you, So you had to create shit for yourself.
That's
in a sense.
That's so true. Yeah, I did.
And maybe that hasn't changed, mm-hmm. you know, because there's no reason why you shouldn't be working unless it's something that you're kind of just over. I know it's fun,
it's so
but something
fun.
Has taken on a lot more meaning in your life rather than being an actor.
Well, you know, when I produced, right, and I had my own production company for years and years, and I produced movies for me and for other people with my partner. But the movies that I wanted to do or produced mostly, other than Burden of Wire and some of these crazy fun things, were about something, mm-hmm. right? It was about women. It was about where we were today. It was like trying to give, you know, a spoonful of medicine and laughing at the same time, and which I thought was the best way to get your messaging across, you know? I felt I was kind of an oddity in a way because that to me, I didn't have 1,000 scripts on my desk the way a lot of women did. I was unusual, and I didn't have the opportunity to read this and read that and say, oh, I want to do that, or maybe I'll do that after that. Never worked out that way. Mm-hmm. And I think I was sort of averaged a year and a half or so between movies.
Really?
Yeah. So I knew somehow that I needed to create my own company. And so we did. I had my own company. And therefore, I was able to create, you know, product, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always creating product, working on scripts, rewriting, working with writers, right? And I think what happened is that as one gets older, things change. Meaning my character was not one that probably would adapt that well to being the old person.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm looking at all of the areas of one's life.
Mm-hmm.
That what are the things that are the truth about you? You know, instead of pretending you're something else,
right?
Or having a fantasy that I can go on and I'll play Madea one day. No, I am always dreaming. And when I was 17, I had my own dancing school. So that should have kind of brought that on. But when I was in my 50s and I went up there with Wyatt, I wasn't waiting for the phone to ring. And mm-hmm. I never wanted my life to be dependent on waiting for the phone to ring,
mm-hmm.
for somebody to want me, to be a pawn on somebody else's board. I just didn't want to do it, not because I felt better than them, but because it wasn't fun.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I created Mind Up. It's how it started slowly, and my travels and all the things that I was interested in at the time, which is spirituality, biology, brain, psychology, and put all of these things together. And that's how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And my dream was a big honking dream. And I sat in my meditation room up there, and I dreamed that I wanted this program to be global because I wanted our children who are going to grow the wrong way and become angry and aggressive. I would like our children to learn how to look at a problem from 30,000 feet up,
mm-hmm.
so they wouldn't have the kind of anger or kind of polarizing personalities not to come to decision-making mm-hmm. together, that we could make a better world through our children's help.
Well, there's psychology there too. You know what I mean? It's about learning who you are and where you came from and why you are the way that you are. You know, why you feel the things that you feel. Not just from a scientific standpoint. Yeah, this is what happens to your amygdala and it's the fight or flight and da-da-da-da. But at what point, I guess, can you get into the psychology of it? You know what I mean? Because you got to dig out the root to really get rid of it.
I agree with you. I think it's vital. And I also think you have to be very, very honest with yourself. We can't just do things where we're going to make ourselves feel better by lying to ourselves. Mm-hmm. We could be responsible for a lot of things. It's like I look at your life and I'm thinking, God damn it, if I could change this, if I could have done that, I didn't know. What mm-hmm. was I thinking? Mm-hmm. I wish I could put time back.
Right.
And I take full responsibility for it. I don't pretend it didn't happen
right.
just to make myself feel better, right? And I think that...
But at the same time, you were doing the best that you could in that
Well, yeah, I mean, I can forgive myself in a way, but at the same time,
it's nothing crazy. I mean, we're talking about something crazy. It's you're a working actor. You know, you're also at that point single for a couple years. You are a grown woman who needs to have experiences, right. Who wants to be with boyfriends, who needs to go out and work and do their thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's just that was the circumstances.
I know. And that was, that's the way it was. And that's the way it is. And I get it. And, you know, and everybody's driven by more than just thought. They're also driven by hormones and all kinds of things in that time of your life. So I get that completely. So I don't know. I mean, I just think that if you don't get down to the bottom, and I did with my family, definitely. I mean, I went deep that was when I was 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27. I mean, I went for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
To what I call the university of me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I could scaffold and dig and excavate all kinds of things that happened to me that made a difference to me. And I had interesting transference with my doctor, who I thought was a genius. I mean, now I could look at and he became everything to me. He became my father. He became my mother. Mm-hmm. I mean, I transferred so much onto him, and I was so friggin' young that it was so helpful for my brain that I was able to look at that and go, gosh, one time I was lying down, it was Freudian, if you can believe it, right? Mm-hmm. And I was lying down and he said, I think you need to lie down and free associate today, Goldie. And I went, oh no, but I'm feeling so good. I feel great. He said, no. You know, try just to lie down and say whatever comes to mind. It was like a punishment. I went, okay. And I would lay there and I go, I'm thinking about my car. I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about whatever. Reminds me of my dad's car. I did the thing. And I was just sifting my brain, like peeling away an onion. Mm-hmm. And everything was coming out. It was sort of like meditation when you're meditating and you've got all these thoughts come in and out of your brain. The idea is to just let them go and come back to your breath or your mantra or whatever. That was just literally thought after thought after thought. Well, it always led me somewhere. And it was fascinating. Of the very things that I felt one time, I was lying there remembering when I was in the crib. Little, and I was lying, playing with my feet like a baby does.
Mm-hmm.
My physicality was matching where I believed I was in my head, and I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I suddenly looked at myself and went, oh my God, I'm lying here like a baby playing with my feet, right? So there's such magic, truly, in peeling away the onion. It's not scary. You know, you can open that window that you think you never want to open, and you realize that it's not that bad.
Right. It's also the commitment. You have to commit to it, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's hard because you have to be vulnerable. And especially for men, I think it's harder to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even with a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Aaron and I went through our shit, you know, when I had my 2 years of just being a horrible human being and spiraling, you know, my therapist didn't even fucking know about it. I didn't even tell him.
Okay.
Because I felt too ashamed to even talk to a professional, someone who's going to keep the secret about it.
Yeah. That's
hard.
Therapy's
hard
but
sometimes.
It's not unusual.
Yeah.
It's not unusual. Coming threadbare, opening your chest, saying, here I am, full frontal nudity.
Yeah.
It's not that bad once you do it.
No, it's not at all.
But the fear, which is, God damn, I'm not opening that door.
Yeah.
Right?
No, I know.
It's amazing.
Very scary.
It's amazing.
You know? I was thinking about this the other night. I was actually talking to Aaron about it, just thinking about my life and where I came from and sort of my being a dad and having a stable relationship with Aaron. It's been 20 years. And I didn't come from that. You know what I mean? You and dad and that divorce, however that went down. Mm-hmm. And then you've got dad's side of the family and that whole thing with his dad, you know. And then I don't know what happened with my like great-grandfather. I have no idea, right? And then on your sides of things, you know, you had dad and then grandma and grandpa were together, but it wasn't like the most healthy, sort of perfect relationship.
Well, they lived apart at toward the last
they did.
Years, yeah.
Yeah.
Near each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think that the way that you carried on in your adult relationships was a reflection of what you witnessed and what you were a part of in your upbringing, you know?
Yeah.
Meaning
in,
like...
In some ways, yes. But they ask, you know, the question is, who are you more like,
mm-hmm.
you know? All right, do you take after your mother? Do you take after your father? I still don't have that answer because I am a traveler like my dad was. I am a curious investigator like my dad was. Mm-hmm. My dad was a musician and I play my body, okay? I've been playing myself for a long time. That's my instrument. My father and I were absolutely best friends. He was quirky.
Mm-hmm.
He was unusual man. And my mother was a very strong, very, as we put it, took us on the table,
mm-hmm.
straight arrow. I mean, truly one of the greats.
Grandma was one of the greats, sure.
So she was very stabilizing because she was strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about it. So I think I'm a little bit of a combination of the two of them.
Yeah.
And I remember that I tried very carefully as I witnessed my own mother, doing some things that I wouldn't do, a little bit more controlling in a way, mm-hmm. And so forth. And I didn't want to be like that, mm-hmm. right? But she loved fiercely. And you knew that you were going to be okay when my mother was around.
Yeah.
So I wanted to... not to be my mother. And I think it's important to differentiate hugely mm-hmm. to that. And my father, I mean, I embody him all the time.
Yeah.
So I think that happened because I went through forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that very young.
Yeah.
That I found out who they were. For instance, my mother... her mother, my grandmother, died when she was 3 years old, my mom. She was basically an orphan. She had no real brothers and sisters. She was an only child. She was 3 years old. And my grandfather gave her to my Aunt Goldie.
Right.
And Aunt Goldie didn't ever let her call her mom or mommy or whatever because of her sister. She had a mother. And with that, Aunt Goldie had seven other children. My mother, at the age of 16, got diphtheria. She lost all her hair.
Whoa, I didn't know this.
And she nearly died.
Really?
So she was there with her father, Max, who came to see her, brought her things. He remarried. And I have to say that my grandfather was... and many people's ideas, not the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mother decided that she was going to go, and the black sheep, by the way, the biggest party fun girl ever,
mm-hmm.
she was going to go to Washington during the war and get a job. And she did. Brave, went with a girlfriend, mm-hmm. Aunt Sal, they got the job,
right.
And she met my dad.
Right.
And she met daddy, and they obviously had sex.
Yeah.
And she got pregnant.
That was the first baby that we just talked about.
And my mother, that's right. Yeah. And that with that, they had to get married. And he died.
Mm-hmm.
And when she had a nervous breakdown,
mm-hmm.
she went to the rabbi. She didn't know what to do. Next thing you know, new baby comes along, and that's my sister, Patty. So my mother looked at Patty, would not leave her all night long. She stared at her in the crib. So if my mother had any issues in life that I may have said, oh, my mom, and then,
mm-hmm.
I learned.
Right, totally.
That she had a hot heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know.
And then you came? I mean, then what was that?
And then I came 8 years later. She made a decision.
8 years later.
She made a decision if she was going to leave daddy. or have another child.
Right.
So she decided.
Good choice.
To have another child.
Yeah. Isn't that a crazy?
Yeah.
Either or, it's like. Oh, let's either get divorced or have another kid. I mean, those are two
well,
ends
of
the
way
spectrum.
Well, it was a way of supporting, like going back and creating more family
mm-hmm.
and going back and being with my dad.
Mm-hmm. And what was grandpa's, your grandparents on that side? What, do you know their story? Like his mom
Otto,
and dad?
I think Otto died kind of early or mm-hmm. something. I never knew him. So when I was still little, you know,
yeah.
I didn't know. And then Granny had four sons, and one of them was my dad, and she's from the South, and she was one of those women. Mm-hmm. She had hourglass figure and looked real good, and mm-hmm. she was one of those. I love my boys. And she was that person.
Yeah.
She used to say, she came to live with us one time, and I was a teenager. I was like 13. And then my mom went to work and daddy went to work. And she said, are you going to leave me alone with Sleeping Beauty again? She was like, I don't think she likes me very much. But no, that was that. But daddy's family was great.
Yeah.
All the brothers and all the cousins. And they were all girls. They had one boy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Stormy was the only boy. All the brothers had girls.
Yeah, I mean, I relate to that because with my situation, I mean, from the outside, you know, with my dad, it's easy just to sort of hate and feel hurt and, you know, just not have any sort of compassion for his situation because it's all about me. But when you really think about it and go back into his life, you know, which I've talked about before,
mm-hmm.
where his dad bailed on him in the middle of the night and he's sitting
horrible.
By the window
horrible.
Waiting for his father to come home.
Right.
Once you know that, and how can one not have compassion and forgiveness
I
for that?
I agree with you. I think
you know
that,
what I mean?
Yeah.
It's for me personally, it's just sort of like, oh man, that's fucking rough. And at that time, no tools,
no.
you know, to deal with that.
No, and neither did his mother.
Right, neither did his mom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just, you're just left to sort of wave in the wind and sort of, you know, move into your life and good luck.
That's right. And you know, you wonder where fear of abandonment comes in or mm-hmm. these kind of things that people live with, which, you know, can create a lifestyle, a long life of fearing people are going to leave you. So that's very unstable,
mm-hmm.
an unstable perspective on your future.
Well, it's coming back to mind up even
yeah.
like, I'm 45 years old, you know, and it took me till I was maybe 40 to truly understand what that forgiveness was after going to Hoffman
mm-hmm.
and dealing with that and breaking down my relationship with you and mm-hmm. with dad and with Pa and all of it.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it be nice to be able to do that earlier? You know what I mean? Because yeah. a lot of these kids have probably struggled with abandonment issues, with parental issues.
Yes.
And I know it's probably hard from a cognitive standpoint, whether you're how developed that brain is.
Right.
But it would be nice to sort of understand that kind of forgiveness earlier on.
Well, that's a interesting, not abstract, but you need to be a certain time and age mm-hmm. to get some level of an understanding like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, mind up. What it does, it prepares a child. It prepares their brain. It gets them used to feeling for someone else. That means that, you know, like compassion, empathy
mm-hmm.
Can be taught, which is really interesting. So when we do with the mind up, we do, you know, first of all, we learn about the parts of the brain that are the emotional parts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we learn about the prefrontal cortex, which is where you can think, make decisions, and so forth. And they learn about that. But in the experiential part of mind up, it starts to fire the brain and the neurons in a way that actually can create habituated thinking, meaning more positive thinking, mm-hmm. or meaning that now we do an exercise where we do acts of kindness. Now, they do this when they're very little. We're starting from preschool and all the way up to eighth grade. So it becomes beautifully habituated in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
when we think do things, when we imagine things, when we are feeling bad, all the and feeling good, same thing, but it's different. Obviously, one's positive, one's negative. But these neurons are firing together, right? Firing, same story you're telling yourself, firing together. Same story I'm telling myself. I'm not very good. Mm-hmm. I'm scared. I'm not going to get home. I'm not going to win. I'm not going to do well. I'm not going to get my grades good. My mom, you know, my brother's bothering me. All negative. That means that they're wiring, meaning they're firing together, means they're wiring together. Mm. When you wire neurons, it's hard to get out of the loop of this sort of internal chat.
Oh, God, I know that. Yeah.
And that is an important part of what we're teaching children in the school. When you understand how these neurons work, you have agency over your own brain by what you put in it. Because your thought is you. Your brain will basically manipulate it.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about memories. We talk about the hippocampus and the things that we do remember and how sometimes we remember scary things, mm-hmm. right? And but we have to understand that we have the understanding that we can supplant some of those things. So when a child feels that way, at least they have more understanding of how to make themselves calm.
Yeah.
And that's their brain break. So yep. we do three times a day a brain break. So now the kids will say, I think I need a brain break, which means that they're becoming aware of themselves and what they're feeling. This is huge.
Yeah.
I mean, if we don't do this when they're young,
yeah.
they won't have the plie that you get to jump. You know, yeah. they won't have preparation.
I wish I had that. I mean, you talked about me. Remember, I was like just negative, meaning like I would start something and get frustrated. And if I couldn't do it, I just quit.
I know.
You know, like I these know. Were negative thoughts, negative patterns mm-hmm. just playing out in my mind, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
How did you deal with that then? With, you know, because obviously you didn't have the knowledge that you do now, but with your kids, what did you do? Do you remember?
I remember saying to you, will you try to, you know, give reaffirmation? Of course you can do it, mm-hmm. honey. You know, it's really simple. You did it before. You did it the other day. It's, you know, a way of trying to help them know that they can do it. But at the same time, your mindset was so strong, and I didn't have, you know, any other tools mm-hmm. than to say, of course you can do it, you know? Mm-hmm. So it is a way of, because you would become anxious, you know? In which case mm-hmm. then I may have said, okay, let's sit down and do our brain break, you know? Mm-hmm. Because there is an example, which is really interesting. We had one child in the class who was an autistic child. That his hands, he couldn't stop shaking his hands. They were taking a test and he went completely anxiety ridden.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the kids came up and said, do you think we could do a brain break and sit around the circle? And the teacher said, of course, and they did, and he stopped shaking his mm-hmm. hands, and he was able to contain himself and take the test.
Mm-hmm.
So these are biological and neurological assets, mm-hmm. happenings. This is the result.
So the brain break isn't a meditation, right?
No.
No. So explain what that is, you know, because
a brain break
is
what every
cool
brain
shit.
Needs a break, yeah. okay? Our brains get overworked, they get overtired.
Yeah. And by the way, adults can do this.
And adults can do it, yeah.
Right.
Is that what we do have is we have something which I believe is a great apparatus, and you can use it however you want. And if you don't have it, it's fine. But what I like is that the chime, okay, is only there because it brings your brain around a sound. That means that you're settling your focused attention on a sound until you can't hear it anymore. That already brings attention to the brain. Then you start to follow your breath. And as you breathe in and out, you realize that that breath is actually going to get irregular. Sometimes you breathe in, sometimes, I take a deep, deep breath. You can do any kind of breath you want. Just follow it. The reality about the brain is that it thinks no matter what. The brain is one of those things that just never stops thinking,
mm-hmm.
as we all could say, oh shit, I wish I could stop my mm-hmm. brain from thinking.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't stop, okay? The brain is not your mind. Your brain is just a function. It's an amazing thing. It's apparatus for us. It's a great downloadable ability, like a computer.
Mm-hmm.
But the brain itself is just a squiggly mass of gray matter with gyri at the top and little areas of the brain that actually where certain things get activated. So that's what you got to know. Thought comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You just let it go like a cloud and come back to your breathing. And this could happen 50 times during a sitting. So when you do your short brain break, know that this is not going to take long.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a bell and did it, it would be awesome. I'd put it at my desk for sure, or where you're working. But at the same time, it is a great ability to relax your brain and your body. Breath, focused. We do it in the classroom mm-hmm. for 3.5 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's it. For an adult, 5 minutes goes by like wildfire. So I think for 5 minutes, you can find time to bring your blood pressure down, mm-hmm. to bring your breath in an easier way. Sometimes when you get really relaxed, your breath is very soft.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find that your breath is going to be much quicker when you start. But then as you settle your body and relax your body in your breath and also your ability to focus on that,
yeah,
then you will.
It's funny too how, you know, especially kids are more, some are more apt to that sitting still and some aren't, because we've done that with three, with Wilder, Bodhi, and Rio.
Yeah.
First of all, Bodhi wants to like meditate every day. He's like, can we do a meditation? Like he gets in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, he sits still and he's in. Wilder is all over the place. He cannot sit still, but that's his nature.
Yeah.
He's just that bubbly sort of, he's got that energy running mm-hmm. through him, or that ADD mm-hmm. or whatever the hell it is, but it's much more difficult for him.
Right. Well, it can be developed though. And what we have to realize is that anything that we want, if you want to do it, it's like dancing. It's like doing a triple pirouette instead of a single one.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to practice. And it's the same thing. That's why they call it a practice.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can learn to quiet your mind.
Oh, yeah. I've experienced that, you know. I've gone through meditations or moments of trying to meditate and where I really stick with it. And from where it begins to where I end, you know, it's night and day. You can drop in much, much quicker, much easier.
You can. You know? It is.
But
like
during my anxiety in the last however long, meditation is extremely important, but it was fucking hard.
Yeah.
It was hard to sit still and actually go there. It was so all over the place.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I found moments, but it was more of just the act of doing it.
I think that's actually important. Sometimes you don't have a good meditation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't. Your brain is active. You've got stuff going on in your mind. It's not easy to become a professional meditator.
Mm-hmm.
But what is important is that you do it.
Yeah. All right, I got to go.
Okay, honey, I love you.
I love you. Thank you, Mom. This was fun.
This is so great.
And it's 45 years I made it. So lungs are good.
You're so great. I love you.
I love you. Bye. Sibling Revelry is executive produced by Kate Hudson and Oliver Hudson.
Producer is Allison Breslin.
Editor is Josh Windisch.
Music by Mark Hudson, a.k.a. Uncle Mark.
If you want to show us some love, rate the show and leave us a review. This show is powered by Simplecast.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.